From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made nearly 1 year ago, December 17th, 2018, when the University of Rochester introduced its new president, Sarah Mengelsdorf, the university's 11th president and the first woman to lead the university. And she took office last summer, was formally inaugurated in October. President Mengelsdorf comes to Rochester from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she served as its provost. She's also a respected psychology professor whose research focuses on the social and emotional development of infants and young children. She joined the University of Rochester during a time of what could be called uncertainty. Former President Joel Seligman resigned in January amid allegations that he and other university leaders covered up sexual harassment allegations against a professor. There have been conversations and efforts on campus since that time to move the campus community forward, a responsibility the new president has inherited as part of that role. This hour, we sit down with President Mengelsdorf to talk about her goals for the area's largest employer, its role related to economic development within the city and the region, how she thinks the campus culture is changing following the events of the last couple of years, and more. Welcome. It's great to have you here in studio.
It's great to be here.
Well, I know the university had a lot of conversations, and we'll get back to what's gone on in the last couple of years, a little rocky at times. So I want to talk a little bit more about your background first, and why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners who don't know essentially where you're from, where you grew up, and sort of the path you took to Rochester.
Okay. I grew up in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, and spent summers on Cape Cod, where my father worked at a laboratory called the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. I went to college near Cleveland, Oberlin College in Ohio, and then went and worked in Philadelphia for a few years, then went to graduate school at University of Minnesota, started my academic career as an assistant professor at the University of Michigan, and then my husband and I were both developmental psychologists, and we both got tenure-track jobs at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, where we spent 17 years, and I moved into administration while I was there, first as an associate department head, then as associate provost, then as department head, then as the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And then we moved to Northwestern, where I also became dean of arts and sciences there, and then most recently provost at the University of Wisconsin prior to coming here.
Before you came here. And a lot of your work in when it comes to infants and young children, yes?
I would say emotional and personality development across the lifespan.
Okay.
Because, of course, when you're studying infants and young children, you're also studying their parents.
Yes.
Yes. And so I've studied, you know, marital couples and how the quality of their marriage affects their parenting and the emotional development of the kids as a function of the quality of the marriage and so forth. So
I ask this not glibly at all. I'm truly wondering if your research background and your expertise is going to help you as you navigate potential. There's nowhere in this country where an organization this large won't have some controversy going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Does it help you?
Well, I think being a psychologist does help me because I have a great deal of interest in people and what makes them tick and why they do what they do. I've also studied family systems and organizations, and, you know, what are the organizational principles of families are also some of the same kinds of organizational principles we see of departments. Mm-hmm. You can have a cohesive one, one that's not cohesive, one that's sort of a hostile environment, one that's a more warm, supportive environment. So early on, when I first went into administration, friends of mine would say, don't you miss having all your time to devote to research? I said, oh, this is just as psychologically fascinating as what I used to do. So,
and you know, one of your alma mater, Oberlin.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. In 2019, Oberlin is sort of a polarizing term, you know, in the
yes.
political world.
It's a shame.
Conservatives have an idea of what Oberlin is, and it's sort of a caricature of liberalism.
Yes.
Maybe performative wokeness or whatever you would call it. You say it's a shame. First of all, tell me why you think that's a shame.
Why do I think it's a shame? Because Oberlin College is a great institution. I got a fabulous education there, and many of my friends did too. I think students there still get a great education, a life-changing education, as a matter of fact. And Oberlin, yes, has a very progressive legacy, one of the first places in the country to, I think, the first coeducational school in the country, and one of the mm-hmm. first to admit African Americans. So it's always had a progressive history. And some of the things it's done have seemed at times extreme to others. At one point when I was at Northwestern, I was meeting with Jeanetta Cole, who is a Oberlin grad who then got her PhD in anthropology at Northwestern. So she's back visiting Northwestern. And the young woman who introduced us said, "But Oberlin, isn't that a weird school?" And Jeanetta said, "Well, by weird, if you mean it was one of the first places in the country to take people with my skin color, or if by weird you mean that you think that women had the right to an education, or by weird it was the first place to have co-ed dorms, and there are very few schools in the country that don't have co-ed dorms, by weird being a place that was open and welcoming to gay students, well, there are lots of schools that like to pride themselves on that now. By weird, it was a stop on the Underground Railroad. There are lots of ways in which it was weird, but lots of other places would be proud to have those things as signatures." So I think it's always been a little bit on the edge there, but lots of those things were good things.
And so, you know, for the maybe the more conservative listeners who think about Oberlin in that way, mm-hmm. they probably think that the products of Oberlin have no nuance, whereas your career, your study, I think begs for understanding the nuance of human beings and, mm-hmm. and our own psychologies and why we form beliefs the way we do and what we do with those beliefs and how we're impacted by those around us. So for those who think that, you know, well, you came out of Oberlin, there's no nuance there, what would you say to that?
Well, I guess, first of all, I think many of us, I knew many people at Oberlin who were very capable of nuance. Did I know people who were extremist, more typically on the liberal end? Yes. But that's they're often activists and on every campus. They make life interesting. They're activists on either end of the political spectrum at most places. There was a Young Republicans group at Oberlin, but it wasn't very large. So you're right to think it was slanted sort of in one way. But I guess I always felt that I was, you know, sort of moderate at by Oberlin standards. I was open to, I had friends with all sorts of, and still do, different political beliefs from different religious backgrounds.
Yeah, and I think that some of the character as well of sort of campus life in general is this idea that there is not an allowance for diversity of thought. There's a lot of talk about diversity, but diversity of thought is not welcome. I mean, my own view is that's, I think that's a caricature.
I think it's a caricature.
I think the University of Rochester indicates that. We've had some wonderful conversations with some of your own faculty members who are certainly politically aligned in very different directions, are writing books in very different directions.
Yes.
But again, for that caricature, which does exist right now, how important is it to allow for diversity of thought? And what does that look like on campus?
It's incredibly important. And I think it's a shame when we don't allow diversity of thought, because then it limits the kind of educational experience we're offering our students. When I was growing up, I remember my dad sponsored my parents, I think, had different kinds of political beliefs. They were kind of a classic gender gap family, so lots of lively dinner table discussions. But he was the sponsor of the College Republicans, because he said, you know, well, the students need a sponsor, and they should be able to hear Buckley and George Will and anyone else they want to hear. And what kind of place would this be if you only hear one set of political views, or you only bring in economists who believe one kind of one side of theory in of economic theory, or political scientists who only have one set of beliefs? So I grew up believing that that was part of what education was about. And my parents would take me to hear speakers of every kind of persuasion all around the city of Philadelphia, because they wanted me to know what different beliefs people had. And within my own family, my mother's family tended to be more conservative. And some of my cousins I'm closest with have different, very different political beliefs. But I think I was brought up to think that all of those views have value.
Do you think speech can be violence?
Do I think speech can hurt people? Yes. One thing that I think is not true is of saying that we used to say out on the playground when I was growing up, you know, when kids called you names, you were supposed to say back, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me." And well, we know that's not true. We know that words can hurt. And so it's a delicate calculus to be able to allow different speech to be heard on campus, when in fact some of the speech could be hurtful to some members of our campus community.
Yeah, this is where I think the push-pull is more nuanced than sometimes these caricatures give credit for, because a lot of the complaints I hear from those who might say that, well, you know, kids these days or students are too soft or everyone wants a safe space, that's usually someone who's not coming from a vulnerable background or position in society. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to kind of keep in mind vulnerability and who is typically who has been and who has not been vulnerable. At the same time, I think there's a difference between looking at, you know, you mentioned Buckley, George Will. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between George Will, William F. Buckley, and Milo Yiannopoulos, even Ben Shapiro, people who are sort of popular among certain movements right now, but they're, to me at least, pretty clearly kind of cynically profiting without actually advancing intellectual causes.
Right.
They're very malleable. So the complaints, I think, are a little bit more valid. I just don't know if they ought to be shouted off campuses. So, I mean, I think it's more interesting than we're sort of giving credit for, but I'm curious to know how you...
Oh, I completely agree with you. There's a huge difference between bringing in intellectuals with different beliefs, people either academics or scholars in other ways. Like, I have heard Supreme Court justices speak. I've heard Scalia speak when he was alive. I've heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I've heard Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan. I haven't heard John Roberts, but I'd like to. And I think those are, you know, those have been really informative. That's different from someone like Milo. I mean, what is Milo's intellectual contribution? I don't know. I see someone like that as more of a provocateur. To get the idea is to incense. And that's a little harder for me to say why I need to protect that kind of performance on our. Now, I don't know whether any of our students have invited Milo to speak or anything.
I doubt it at this point. Milo seems to be sort
faded.
Of off the scene.
Yeah, but Ben Shapiro came to Wisconsin when I was there.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay. What were there protests?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But no one was hurt.
Sure. Yeah, and so I just think. I think the conversation is a little bit more interesting than the two camps seem to be. But at the same time, I have an affinity for at least countering speech with speech when possible.
Oh, I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Talking to the new president of the University of Rochester, Sarah Mangelsdorf, and, you know, so you come to the University of Rochester at a time where I think the university wants not only to grow and heal and thrive, but move on from what happened in the last couple of years. And, you know, in 2017, 2018, can't tell you how many people I heard say, next president must be a woman, has to be a woman, everything we've gone through. When did you first hear about the University of Rochester? When did you first come to Rochester? When's your first memory coming to Rochester?
My first formal visit to the University of Rochester was probably about 10 years ago when I was an arts and sciences dean. The University of Rochester hosted the AAU Arts and Sciences Deans, mm-hmm. as we have national, you know, annual meetings, and different universities take turns hosting. And I stayed at the Staybridge and went over the footbridge and went to the meeting at the library and so on. That was the first time I'd actually been on the campus. But I'd been in Rochester. We often would do road trips from the Midwest to the East Coast and stop and explore different places in New York. So,
okay. And probably had no inkling at the time that here you are 10 years later
in this
position. When did the idea of this job first land on your radar?
Well, as you probably know, for university presidents, they typically hire search firms that are colloquially, you know, often referred to as headhunters.
Yeah, of course.
And the search firm in charge of the presidential search at University of Rochester reached out to me, and she said, Sarah, I think I have one that would be perfect for you. And she described University of Rochester. And she thought in part that my having gone to, and she's right about this, having gone to Oberlin, where many of my friends were musicians in the conservatory, that I would have a particular understanding and appreciation of the Eastman School and as a part of University of Rochester and what a, you know, value that is to the university and the community. So,
and there's no doubt about that.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. When did you sort of know, though, that this was actually going to happen, that this is the job, this and everything that it entails?
Well, the way it works is, you know, first they'll reach out to you and they'll say, you know, there's this job coming up and let me send you the job description. Mm-hmm. And so there's usually a sort of brochure that comes and it's, you know, highlights features of the surrounding area and talks about the history of the university. And of course, in this day and age, you can do a lot of research about universities online. But let's be clear, I already knew about the University of Rochester for many, many reasons. My undergraduate advisor at Oberlin got his PhD in psychology here at Rochester. And Rochester has always had a very strong history in psychology, just as it does in medicine and music and so many other fields. So I had known friends who'd gone to medical school here. I'd known friends who'd gone to the Eastman School. So I had lots of knowledge of some of the strengths, not all of the strengths. I didn't know anybody in the Institute of Optics, though I knew physicists who'd done research at the laser lab. So I had some sense of the, you know, the range of strengths at the university.
Sure. And did what had happened in 2017 and 2018 give you any pause? And of course, listeners remember the Florian Jaeger and the allegations of sexual harassment and the campus sort of protests and the back and forth. I mean, did that give you any pause about taking this job?
No, not really. Of course, I knew about all of that. There was a lot of national press. And keep in mind, I'm also a psychologist, and I know many of the people in brain and cognitive sciences, including a number of the complainants. I guess... As someone who just came from being provost at a large public research university where provosts typically handle faculty disciplinary cases, I handled all the faculty disciplinary cases at the University of Wisconsin. I handled a number when I was dean at Northwestern and some others when I was dean at University of Illinois. I'd like to say that universities are utopian places and no one ever misbehaves, but, you know, it's not true. And so to me, it didn't seem, it was very unfortunate that the university got as much awful national press, but did, and I'm not in any way condoning Jaeger's behavior at all, but it is in the realm of the things I have dealt with in my years in higher ed administration. So it didn't seem like, wow, this university has had such a crisis that worse than anything I've ever seen, I don't know how I could possibly go into that place. Instead, I thought that's a place that's in need of healing, mm-hmm. and maybe I could help with that.
Right, that fair enough. And I hope as we get to know each other better over the years, you'll recognize that one of our goals here on this program is to always ask direct questions, never in bad faith. We don't mm-hmm. do gotcha questions. So there's always a purpose. I mean, unfortunately, some modern journalism, especially cable news, sort of is meant to get sort of a quick soundbite or pitting against each other. And I understand there's certain things you can't talk about. We still hear in this building from some of the complainants, some of the people who've gone in different directions in their lives and careers, people like Celeste Kidd and Jessica Cantlin and others. Have you been in touch with them? Do you feel it's appropriate? And do you think that they were treated poorly by the university in any way? Do you have any regret about that? I understand you weren't here.
You know, and much of this took place, actually. I mean, Joel left, I guess, last in January of 18, almost 2 years ago. And what the things you're talking about took actually more years ago than that. And so, you know, I can't really comment about the legal proceedings at this point in time. And I don't want to be an armchair quarterback about what the university should or shouldn't have done. It's always easy to look back on what's been done in the past and suggest you could have done something differently. In fact, that's one of the things we do at president's retreats of the AAU, and we did that as provost. Look at case studies of other universities. How might you have handled this crisis that happened on this campus? And I can't. I would feel uncomfortable making comments about decisions people made 3 years ago.
I think that's fair. I also, you know, understand that your position and ours in the media is not parody in dealing with these situations, but there will be times where there are allegations. Until human beings stop existing, there will probably be allegations about inappropriate behavior or allegations of sexual harassment. And one of the things that we've been asked a lot in the media in the last couple of years is, you know, do you finally believe women? I look a lot at the work of Ronan Farrow for The New Yorker, who, of mm-hmm. course, was one of the journalists who helped bust open the Harvey Weinstein story, among others, who says, when he's asked that question, he says, no, it's not a situation of just believe women. It's take women's claims seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And take all claims seriously,
take,
of course.
Take all claims
seriously. But generally speaking, you know, the vast majority of these allegations come from women who've often been harassed or say they've been harassed by men. And Farrow says, take them seriously, because the issue is they have not been taken seriously for far too long. And if you take them seriously, follow everywhere it leads without prejudice, no matter where it goes, mm-hmm. even if it takes a lot of work and resources and time, take it seriously, finally. And I think that's good counsel for journalists. What's your view going forward to ensure your faculty and everyone on campus, students as well, that they will be protected and respected in regards to sexual harassment and everything that we would sort of call as part of the Me Too era?
Well, one of the things I would say, Evan, is that I do think University of Rochester did a lot of work last year under the leadership of Interim President Rich Feldman. The whole campus worked on revising their policies, including this policy 106 about sexual harassment. I think this was really a wake-up call to the university that perhaps their policies were not as strong as they could be or as clearly written as they could be in defining what was appropriate and inappropriate behavior. And the university spent a lot of time on that. There's also a lot of time spent on thinking about improving reporting mechanisms. So if you, a student, faculty, staff, regardless of who you are, you feel you have been a victim of harassment, there, you know where to go, and there's someone to talk to. And we also greatly improved the training that all people have to go through. I think there are different trainings for different groups, and I, as a supervisor, had to go through a certain kind of training. And having gone through sexual harassment and sexual violence prevention training at a number of institutions, I can honestly say this was the best, most realistic training I had ever been through. Some of them, the scenarios seem so, you know, obvious that who could, you know, none of those things would ever happen. But actually, it's some more subtle forms of human interaction, which I think are more difficult to label as that's harassment. And I thought our training did a really good job of that. Also did a good job of emphasizing what was the role of faculty members, for example, when students came to them to complain about another faculty member. You know, they couldn't just say, oh, you know, this isn't confidence. If a student says they want you to keep it in confidence, you actually can't if someone has come to you and reported harassment or violence. And so I think the university has greatly improved its policies, its procedures. We're trying to make our campus the safest place it can be. In fact, when we participated with other research universities in this country in something called the AAU Sexual Assault, Sexual Harassment, it was survey just to sort of get at the incidence rates around our campuses, the incidence rates of different kinds of behaviors, and also who were the victims, undergraduates, graduate students, so forth. And I can honestly say University of Rochester had a lower rate of both sexual harassment and sexual violence than compared to our AAU peers, other major research universities in this country. That's not a particularly, you know, at first we wanted, folks wanted to broadcast something about that. And I said, no, I don't think it's really a good headline to say, hey, our sexual assault rate is only 10% compared to sure. national average of 20. You know, that's not great. But it's similar to what you see outside of college campuses among the same age group as well.
Sure. And so a couple more quick questions on this, and then in our second half hour, we're going to talk economic development, other priorities, as the new president of the University of Rochester takes a look at the scene here and looks forward. And we're going to talk about what your vision entails here. In regards to your view, I know I'm kind of hinging a lot on your psychological background and expertise, but I do think it's so interesting and probably valuable in this case. From the 30,000-foot view of the Me Too movement, do you see it as, I can't see it as anything but a net gain right now for mm-hmm. society, mm-hmm. If an imperfect one.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the critics say, well, no, people don't trust each other. Men don't want to work with women on trips. They don't want to travel. They don't want to hire women for projects. There's going to be backlash. There's going to be costs, mm-hmm. unintended consequences. because of fear. And I'm just curious to know how, from that 30,000 foot level, not even really a University of Rochester question, but generally speaking, how do you see the movement affecting and benefiting or otherwise society?
Oh, I think ultimately it will benefit society. This was a much needed sort of course correction. I mean, I think women, I don't think there are very many women that you could talk to of, certainly of my age, who in some work environment didn't experience some form of sexual harassment. And I think it's good that we as a society are waking up and saying, no, that's really not appropriate.
Do you fear any consequences that were not intended from that?
Well, anytime there's a swing of the pendulum where we look more carefully at something, could there be people who might be wrongly accused? Well, perhaps. But on the other hand, if we're careful about how we do our investigations and don't jump to conclusions, then I think if we have fair investigations, it's the best thing. People should come forward.
And it sounds like you're pretty comfortable right now with what the university has learned and has in place to deal with this going forward. Is that fair?
Yes. I think there's still room for improvement? I would like to, if possible, it would be great to hire another investigator. You know, it's because one of the things that happens when in society, when you open up you say it's okay to talk about these things, then more people come forward. It doesn't necessarily mean there's a higher incidence rate, mm-hmm. but people are willing to come forward. And if they're willing to come forward, we need to be able to investigate things promptly.
And then putting the last point on this, how do you see morale, whether it's among faculty, campus? I don't want to get too inside baseball, but, you know, we hear about things like the Genesee Staff Council and mm-hmm. and the efforts to communicate and to discuss issues like morale. How do you see that right now?
Well, I think morale seems pretty good, but, you know, I do know that the issues the staff have been concerned about, and I think the Genesee Staff Council is really a step in the right direction so that we in the administration will have staff representatives we can go to get their input, get their advice about various things facing our campus so that they're not, you know, they don't just hear about this has been decided. They get to have input when we're making certain policy changes and so forth.
Let me take one phone call on the subject before we get our second half hour. This is Michaela in Rochester. Go ahead, Michaela.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I turned on the program, and I am a student. I was a student at U of R. I'm still in the area. And it reminded me of a personal experience I had. So when I was a senior and fifth year student, I was involved in a club, and it was a co-ed club. And during that time, some underclassmen approached us and told us about behavior that was sexual assault from one of the other club members. And personally, I had had bad experiences with this guy before, but nothing physical that I felt like have addressed immediately. So, we were kind of at a loss, me and the few other senior members of the team who were approached. And so we were like, okay, what do we do? We go to the Title IX office because that's what we're told to do. And we got to the Title IX office, and basically we were told that unless those individuals wanted to come forward and file a complaint, they could do nothing. And the individuals who had approached us with their problem with this other guy had already had really bad experiences filing sexual assault complaints with the university. It actually kind of blew up in the Campus Times. It was kind of a thing that was part of that watershed year of 2017-2018. And anyway, I just wanted to make the comment that besides sort of disagreeing with the current mechanisms in place to deal with sexual assault on campus, there's two other points, one of which is that when you have a person in your friend group who is immature and doesn't know how to control himself, it almost feels like because he is part of your social group, it is your duty to reform him because you're his friends, right? Mm-hmm. Or allegedly his friends. And if you take him to the curb, he becomes a problem for a different group of people. He becomes a predator for a different group. So like we felt like it was our duty to reform him, but at the same time we felt at a loss for help from the university to do that. And the other thing I wanted to say, the second point, is just that I have skepticism generally with the university dealing with sexual assault problems, because when you deal with a problem internally, such as sexual assault, and it doesn't get reported to the police, there isn't any record that needs to be public about what's actually going on campus. So the encouragement to go to the Title IX office with your complaint, I feel sometimes is doubly wrong, because they don't do much, and it also keeps it shrouded in secrecy. Mm-hmm. So that's my comment. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, Michaela, thanks for calling. Go ahead, President Minister.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about your experience. That sounds pretty tough. What year was this?
I think she said 2017.
2017? I mean, it does sound like it is the case that it, you know, and this is the federal law. This is not our law. Mm-hmm. That you can't complain. It's hard to complain on someone else's behalf. You need to, you know, you have to have someone, a complainant of record. There has to be someone willing to come forward to complain. But it sounds like in this particular case, they also felt like they were betraying a friend, that they mm-hmm. should perhaps be able to change his behavior. I'm sorry if she felt the Title IX office was not receptive or at all constructive. And we have made a number of changes and perhaps more needed, but we've really been trying. And regarding this issue of what's a Title IX complaint, what's a complaint to the police, it is always an option for anyone to go to the police. We dealt with this at the University of Wisconsin has its own police force, but that works along with the city police. And students always had the option of going to the police. But there were many, many cases that the police said we can't press charges, we don't have enough on this. But that doesn't mean the university might not want to discipline someone based on behavior that might not be rise to illegality, but could be inappropriate given the campus culture. So it's a complicated thing. It's not like universities want to adjudicate all these cases.
And I got a comment from a faculty member who said, the president's right. The online training was nuanced, and I learned something.
Yeah.
So that comes from a faculty member at U of R. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back, and we're going to talk about a lot of other subjects with the new president of the University of Rochester. Sarah Mangelsdorf is with us here in studio on this Monday afternoon. First time we had a chance to sit down with her since she came to the university just about a year ago announced, and now on the job, I guess, since officially inaugurated in October. But really been here
started
for a while.
July 1st.
In July, yeah. Hmm. There you go. We're right back with the new president next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Adam Urbanski in studio, the president of the Rochester Teachers Association. He's been in that job for several decades now, and one of our guests last week said that Urbanski is partially to blame for the crisis in Rochester schools. He responds and then some. We'll talk about what teachers are doing during this crisis and how they're responding to proposed cuts next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I've been in Rochester since 2003, so that was well after the peak of Kodak in the 80s. But right across the street, I mean, there used to be 65,000 people working at Kodak alone in Rochester, and now the largest employer is the University of Rochester and its various systems. And so, economic development, Joel Seligman, one of your predecessors, was heavily involved with economic development councils. Are you going to be?
Yeah, I'm going to be on a board called ROC 2025, certainly do see my role in the community as a very important part of the role as president of University of Rochester.
When it comes to the university and the medical system and the center, the research, in terms of employees, I mean, I haven't seen the latest count. I don't know exactly how many employees do you have, and it's in the range of, what is it?
Over 32,000.
Over 30,000. Okay,
but
so
that includes people at the affiliate hospitals and med centers.
How much responsibility do you feel now, knowing that there's your largest regional employer right there? Not Kodak anymore, not Xerox, not B&L.
It's a big responsibility. It's a big responsibility, and I think we all take it very seriously. You know, it's funny you said the 65,000. Some people have said 85,000 people employed at Kodak. I've heard so many different statistics.
I think it's in the 60s.
I want to know the truth. Anyway, or maybe how many were employed here in Rochester.
Sure.
But clearly, That must have been, I hear all these stories, and there are lots of people here who grew up here and, you know, their parents were employed by either Kodak, Bosch and Lomb, Xerox, and that was a different era. And now, obviously, we're the major employer, but then there are a number of other Rochester area colleges, and then, and healthcare is a big employer, not just us, but other healthcare units, and then smaller startup companies. It's just a really different mix in the city than it was. But as the biggest employer, there is a great sense of responsibility that what does it mean? We don't just want to be the biggest employer. We want to be a good employer. We want to be a place that people want to work because they want to be there and they see pathways to, you know, the ways they can advance themselves if they want to and seek new opportunities and move up a career ladder. And that's something we'll be working on, trying to work on in the coming years in our HR system, giving a sense of how you get from point A to point B if you're working at the University of Rochester. I think it's clear for professors, assistant professor, associate professor. It's less clear in some of our staff roles.
Sure. And you know, in terms of the comparison to Kodak, what happened to Kodak is not going to happen at the University of Rochester. You're not going to see 32,000 employees go to 2,000 at some point.
No.
But there's a question going forward about whether we're sort of reaching a saturation point with the sticker price of school and tuition, et cetera. I read a lot of your remarks from the Rochester Review, for example, about tuition, the cost of higher ed, loan debt. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to just ask for some general remarks first on you on this, because it's a broad area. We know loan debt's a huge problem in this country, but we also hear from so many leaders in higher ed who get frustrated when we don't distinguish between a sticker price and an actual price, et cetera. How do you view that?
Well, I don't blame people for getting confused about a sticker price and an actual price. It's very confusing. It's like going to buy a car and there's a sticker price, but you know you're supposed to negotiate and haggle, and the blue book will tell you that you're supposed to ask for something. You know, it's kind of complicated. And at one point I was trying to explain this whole financial aid system that we use in this country when my older daughter was in high school. She goes, a lot of people feel they can't go to those schools because they're too expensive. I said, well, actually, if your family doesn't earn very much, you don't have to pay very much. I was explaining the whole way it worked, and she goes, well, that's just confusing. Why not make it simpler? And I thought, you know, there's something to this. So certainly in my days in public higher ed, I was trying to make it simpler. So we created at Wisconsin something called Bucky, the badger is the mascot. That's what it's called. Bucky's tuition.
I did not know that.
Bucky's tuition promise. So anyone who was coming from a family at or below the median income in the state of Wisconsin had free tuition. You know, so which wasn't all that different than what we were doing before, but we were just telling people very clearly, here's what you're going to pay. And we got, as a result, we got more lower income students applying because then they thought, hey, it's not out of reach. I could apply to this place. And so I don't think the way we do tuition and financial aid packaging is particularly clear to people. In higher ed in general, we've tried to be better. So on the websites, like if you go to financial aid, you can sort of, given your family's income, if you put in the income, you can get a sense of what you'd have to pay, at least, you know, a round estimate. But it is the case that the more you earn, the more you pay. The less you earn, the less you pay.
And that's not going to change, is it?
I don't think so. I don't see how. One of the things we are trying to do on our side is to raise more money for endowed scholarships. And so instead of that will help subsidize some of the costs of the education. And that's going to be a big goal in our fundraising going forward.
What percentage of your students pay that full number, the full sticker?
16%.
84% are getting some kind of assistance.
That's right. And this year's data, that's what it says.
You think that surprises people?
It surprised me. That's higher than some of our peer institutions. Yeah.
16% higher?
No. 84%.
Oh, 84%
of students getting financial aid is higher than many of our peer institutions.
Okay. But when you talk about endowed scholarships, you talk about ways to make sure the university is truly accessible.
Mm-hmm.
How far do you have to go before you're satisfied that students of color, students from economically disadvantaged districts, from all kinds of backgrounds, can get in the door and be part of the community at U of R? Are you there where you want to be yet?
We're not quite where we want to be, because right now I think that we are using too much of our general operating budget to cover financial aid. We need to raise it needs to be part of our endowment so that we can give the kinds of financial aid packages that we want to. And it would be great to, you know, there's some schools in this country, and we're certainly not there, where they're literally need blind. Like, I accept you and you'll be, we'll give you what you need, regardless of what your family's earnings are. And but most schools in the country can't afford to do that. So,
okay. And do you feel like you're on a path to get there?
We're on a path, certainly. We do 19% of at least of our undergraduates are Pell eligible, which so coming from the lowest two income quintiles in this country. And we have a great commitment to access. And about 20% of our students are first generation college. And that's very important to us because education is the path to social mobility.
Before I snag two more phone calls, let me just ask, I don't mean this in a trite way, because when we talk about the, you know, the role as a woman, I mean, your role is as a leader. You happen to be the first woman who's in charge of this university and this institution. So in that sense, is there added weight of responsibility for you?
A little bit. In that, I can't tell you how many female students, female faculty, female staff, female alumni, ranging in age from, you know, 25 to 95, say to me, "We are so thrilled to have our first female president," and it feels like a special burden, and an honor. But a great responsibility. I think, well, gee, you know, I don't want to blow it because then they might not ever want to hire a woman again.
isn't that ridiculous, though? And this idea of this notion that, well, we can elect a female president. As long as we do that once, you know, we can go back to electing men. We can appoint or we can hire a woman to be in charge of this organization. But as long as we do that once. And that has been that's actually true in a lot of countries. That's true in a lot of organizations. So that pressure that you describe, I mean, unfortunately, it has a historical precedent, which is
certainly in higher ed, it has some precedent. Mm. Though, on the other hand, there's some, like some of the Ivy League schools. I think Brown is on their second female president, University of Pennsylvania's second female president. But some of the others, it's like, oops, we checked that box.
Well, and we've talked about some of the work that you've had to do in regards to what's happened before you came in. What is your wish list to accomplish in the short and the long term here that we haven't talked about? What do you really want to get done?
Well, one of the things I really want us to work on, and you know, Sarah Miller, who's here with us today, is part of the communications team. And this one of the things our university needs to do better is to market and brand itself as one university. And I don't mean to take away from the identity of the Eastman School of Music or the Simon School of Business or the Laser Lab or any of these individual entities that are excellent or the medical center. But the problem is, in the world as a whole, many people don't know those individual pieces are even part of the university, including my husband. When I was applying to this job and listing all the strengths of University of Rochester, and I said, "And Eastman School of Music is such a gem," he said, "That's part of University of Rochester?" He thought it was a freestanding school of music like Juilliard. And over Thanksgiving break, my son-in-law said, "Hey, Sarah, I hear there's a national, really famous national DOE, Department of Energy, laser lab here in Rochester." I said, "It is not a national lab. It is part of the University of Rochester. It does have DOE funding." He said, "Oh, I thought it was like Fermi and Argonne." Those are, you know, labs based in Chicago where he lives. And I said, no, it's part of our university. And so a lot of people know about these discrete spires or silos of excellence, but they may not in their mind connect them all to the University of Rochester. So I think we end up being perceived in the national and international imagination as perhaps somewhat less than the sum of our parts. And I would really like us to work on that, which is not uncomplicated.
No, but understandably important. We have the same issue at XXI. We've got the little theater and the radio station and PBS TV, WXXI TV, NPR. Sometimes people forget all the things under one umbrella.
Right, right,
okay.
Right.
It's a good goal. Calvin in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Calvin.
Hi, Evan. You took my question.
You should be hosting the show.
Hi, President Mangelsdorf.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I guess this is sort of spin on what Evan just asked. How would you, or what do you have any goals on in terms of the perception that the University of Rochester, so we, one of the things that I see in the work that I do is a lot of students not feeling like they are as connected to the community, the city of Rochester, neighborhoods like the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood especially, in ways that are concrete. Oftentimes.
Oh, wait, Calvin, have I met you before?
We have met.
Yeah, yes. Day of service. Yeah, sure. Yes, I recognize your voice.
Yes. So I guess my question would be, do you see any potential to better connect or improve the connections that students have with organizations in the city of Rochester in more sustainable ways? So there are groups and clubs that do it each year, but oftentimes when those students, you know, they go up in grade or they
yeah, there for semester and then gone.
Yeah, those connections don't sustain systemically across the university.
You know, this is something that's really important to us. And last year, President Feldman asked a group of people to sort of get together to catalog all the different things that people from the University of Rochester, student groups, faculty, staff were doing in the community. And we were sort of shocked to discover there were 300 such partnerships with 200 different agencies in the city. But the very fact that many people didn't know what other folks were doing struck me as a bit of a problem, that there's this lack of interconnection, even. And if you, Calvin, wanted to reach out to the university, say, hey, I would love to have some students work with us all year round. Who do I connect with? I bet you wouldn't know. Would you know who to contact?
I would not.
Yeah, no. That's a problem. I think that ultimately it would be really great if we had one person who is the point of connection for all our community partners and vice versa for all our people in the university who wanted to work in the community who could serve as a liaison. That is something I see. I think we do a lot. Could we do more? And I agree with you that it needs to be sustained and coordinated. We have great students who actually, I think, 90% of our students are involved in extracurricular activities, and many of those are involved in extracurricular activities in the community. But then there is, there are challenges, as you know, for a public transportation system in the city of Rochester. So how do we get the students to various sites if they don't have cars? And we had four international students at our house for Thanksgiving dinner. I asked any of them whether they'd been to downtown, whether they'd gone to hear concerts at Eastman, and none of them had. They said, oh, the shuttle bus doesn't run often enough.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we're not even doing as good a job as perhaps we could in connecting our students with all parts of our own campus and the city. But it's something we really want to work on, because when it works really well, like our partnership with East High School is going well, though I'm worried with the most recent teacher layoffs. But that's a sign of a partnership that involves the Warner School, it involves the School of Medicine, it involves nursing, it involves the Flom Eye Institute, Eastman Dental, and all signs are pointing in the right direction. The graduation rates are up, and the students seem very passionate about their schools, as do the teachers and staff.
Calvin, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call, Evan.
You got it. Thank you. Thank you, Calvin. And in our last 90 seconds or so, briefly, Amanda wants to know, do you support any of the proposals for student debt relief that we're seeing? Probably talking about on the national level, either student debt relief or funded tuition, et cetera. Anything that you see that makes sense to you?
I don't know specifically which proposal she's talking
about. There's probably a Warren plan, a Sanders plan. There's probably some other combination plans out there.
I certainly endorse the plan. There have been a number of things over the years where if you went to do public service, you would get tuition relief.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been supportive of those. And there have been programs in our country to give relief to doctors, tuition relief for doctors who plan to practice in rural areas where there's a doctor shortage. The same for lawyers. I'm very supportive of those kinds of programs. An overall across the board relieving everyone of debt, I'd probably have to see the details, how that would be funded and who would get it.
Yeah.
Right.
Last 30 seconds. What surprised you most about Rochester?
What a neat city it is. My husband and I are really enjoying exploring Rochester and its surrounding areas. We've driven along Route 90 on many a road trip and explored some of the areas around. But the beauty of the Finger Lakes, we love runs and bike rides, and now I guess cross-country skiing before too long, along the river, along the Erie Canal, exploring the parks. The cultural life is quite vibrant, and all kinds of different little restaurants and shops and little nooks of the city. I feel like I only went to the Little Theater for the first time the night before Thanksgiving, and I was like, my God, this place is splendid. There are lots of gems here, and it's been people have been incredibly welcoming, and there's a lot more here than I would have imagined, and we're really loving it.
We know how busy your calendar is, and we appreciate the time and the opportunity to talk to you. Such an important role in our community, and we hope to see much more of you. Thank you very, very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
You got it. That is the new president of the University of Rochester. We have to stop saying new at some point. Sarah Mangelsdorf, the University of Rochester. More connections. Adam Urbanski, president of the Rochester Teachers Association, speaking of the situation with the school district. That's next hour.